Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and here I am with the Anna Stocky. We're going to be talking all about math and her podcast, which has changed the world and the landscape in a lot of ways of social media and math education, in my view. We're going to dig into some of sort of the recent developments from some of her guests and what's going on in the world of math. But before that, let me talk about our sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by John Catt Educational from Hachette Learning, and they produce amazing books, including my own book, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. Go ahead and check out the catalog that I put in the show notes and get yourself some books. As you also know, I'm the director of StepLab North America, and we're constantly doing courses for leaders and instructional coaches all around how to coach teachers in the science of learning. Check out the show notes for those links. There's lots of courses year-round, and I hope to see you there. Anna, it is so great to finally have you by yourself on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I say by yourself because last time you were on here, we had a panel of Amanda Vanderhayden and Nate Joseph and a whole bunch of great guests. I've just been wanting to pick your brain on this show for so long because you're one of the few podcasts I listen to like faithfully, religiously, every single time an episode comes out.
Okay, well, I'm going to start giving you quizzes on what was discussed on the podcast then to make sure that's true and that you've actually been listening. But thank you. I love your podcast too.
I'd love for you to introduce yourself sort of fully, because I think folks that listen to your podcast, but they might not fully know your background and your bio. Like, are you a teacher? Are you a education professor? Like, what exactly is it you do?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess you could say I'm a grade 13 math teacher. So I teach at the university level. So I'm a mathematician. I have a PhD in math, and I'm a math professor at the University of Winnipeg here in Canada. But people, your audience will know about me because of, if they do know about me, because of my work in math education. So I don't work in a faculty of education. I don't do education research. I'm a math education advocate. So, and I've been doing advocacy for around 15 years. In fact, I co-founded an advocacy group around probably 15 years ago to advocate for better math instruction for kids. And I also co-founded and I co-run a nonprofit organization called Archimedes Math Schools, and we deliver after-school programming for kids to help them catch up in math or to get enrichment activities in math. And I host the math education podcast, Chalk and Talk.
It's been a great new season so far. Last season was just pound for pound amazing. Tell us, like, what were some of your top episodes, just kind of before we dig into that?
Oh, sure. Okay, so my top episode in terms of downloads would be Brian Ponce's episode on, I think we called it Math Fact Crisis. And actually my solo episode, How to Gain Automaticity or How to Teach Automaticity with Math Facts, I can't even remember what I called it now, that's also really popular. And recently, a very popular episode is the one with Nick Gibb about how England improved its math scores and its reading scores. Generally, people seem to like the podcasts that link math to reading as well. Like, I have a recent one out with Ben Solomon. We called it Balanced Literacy Didn't Work, Will Balanced Math. And that one is actually quite popular as well. And everybody likes you, Zach. So of course, the episode we did, that recent mailbag, is also very popular.
I was waiting. I was like, oh, really?
I'm sorry.
Didn't even make the top five?
No. That one is very popular.
I'm interested in this because, you know, this is a little bit like inside baseball with podcasting, but it has taken up a lot of my time, this podcast. And we share sort of similar experiences with getting guests on and seeing them before the scenes and after. I'm just curious about, like, of the guests, did any of them really challenge your thinking, maybe even lead to you adjusting certain opinions that you've had?
I'll mention a couple. You know, I knew about the science of learning, and I've read about the research for quite some time now. But the science of learning tends to be associated with cognitive psychology. And so, you know, I came to know of Amanda Vanderhayden's work And she introduced me to a lot of other people like Ben Solomon and Robin Cotting, et cetera. And then I kind of discovered that, wait a minute, there's this other group of psychologists, the behavioral psychologists or behavior science. I don't even know what the correct terminology is because I'm actually not a psychologist. And, you know, I didn't realize there was a rift between cognitive psychology and behavioral psychology. I don't know if you knew about that. Did you know that?
I guess I just assumed that the behavior psychologists who I really have come to admire in terms of like just the specificity and the concreteness of some of the techniques and so on, and the whole science, the descriptions of the science, I guess I thought it was sort of extinct. And then I just realized there's this whole world, especially in special education. Like, it was also a surprise to me too.
Yeah, they're amazing. And I really like the focus on measurement. So anyway, I had Kim Behrens on the podcast, and she has this book called Blind Spots, I think. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Or Educational Blind Spots. And she is very outspoken. And so when I was reading her book, it kind of dawned on me that, oh, okay, there's this conflicting viewpoint. But to me, I mean, I guess sort of more of a novice when it comes to psychology. To me, they're just kind of saying the same things. Like, they come to the same conclusions, but in different ways. And so she told me about that, and she challenged some things like talking about cognitive load theory, working memory, because you can't really see it, right? You can't measure it. So I guess she challenged my thinking quite a bit. But also, she made me aware that there's these different groups, which I kind of appreciated. And I would say the other guest that made me kind of think about some things was Jonathan Plucker. And so I had him on because I wanted to talk about advanced education. And he's an expert on advanced education. So if anybody out there wants to know about educating advanced students, I would definitely recommend checking out that episode. But I guess I hadn't really thought about ability grouping or flexible ability grouping, as he calls it, as being something that might actually help students. You know, you kind of, certainly in Canada, I would say the education world is really anti-streaming in a lot of cases. And so I guess my thinking kind of was influenced by that. But he really made me think about that, about how actually maybe flexible ability grouping could help kids, even kids who struggle, especially kids who struggle, is what the research I think shows. So yeah, so I would say those are a couple of the guests that really challenged my thinking.
Do you ever feel like when you're behind the chair and you're talking to them, like the need to push back or to, I don't know, stop them in their tracks? I feel a huge responsibility to the listener to like also represent my own views, but I also understand that I hope they have the maturity to realize this is a guest who's speaking for themselves and I'm only, but then I feel like I'm platforming them. Like, have you felt these sort of these conflicts that I have while recording these?
Well, sort of. So first of all, when I invite people on my podcast, it's because I think they have something important to say that's going to help the listeners. And I'm not going to invite someone on the podcast who's pushing pseudoscience and then argue with them. I have no interest in doing that, or platforming people that are pushing things that are not evidence-based. So I look at that pretty carefully. And I mean, sometimes I have people on just because I want to know more about that particular topic. So for instance, I had Mike Petrilli from Fordham Institute because I was interested in learning about standardized testing in the United States because I'm from Canada and, you know, it's quite different. But generally, I try to have people on that are either researching and they're doing high quality research that I think could be generalizable to the public, or they're using methods that would be backed by that kind of high quality research. I it's my podcast, I'm the host. My feeling is, and some people think of this differently. If, you know, you might have a different opinion than me, but I feel like I should be a good host and I shouldn't bring people on and argue with them, right? I mean, they're, you know, people aren't going to want to come back to your house if you bring them into your house and then you start asking them questions and arguing with them, right? So I want people to actually come on my podcast. So I generally don't do that. So, you know, I wouldn't want to undermine my guests or argue with them or anything like that. So, you know, likely, usually when I have guests on, I tend to already kind of agree with what they're going to say. So it makes it unlikely that I'm going to argue with them. But nonetheless, I tend not to argue unless I think if they say something that I think is really wrong, I probably will push back.
It's interesting to just speak to you about this because I just think of also some other guests who have sort of decided to vet the hosts before they go on because a lot of people come to me and they think I'm going to argue with them. Like they say ahead of time, like, I just don't want to really. And I'm going, oh, no, that's not how I wanted to talk about this. And they go, oh, okay, that's fine. We are in a very politically and partisan sort of charged kind of state right now, especially I think in the US, I'm sure in Canada. One of the thread lines that goes across maybe all your episodes are around sort of math myths, misconceptions, things that people believe that are really counterproductive. I'm curious, maybe name one that you feel like you'd really like to dispel right now. And maybe one that you think that it's still a myth, but there's just maybe you secretly think there's a grain of truth to it. You want to give us those?
Oh, sure. Okay. So first you're looking for one that I'd like to dispel. All right. I could pick a few, but this is the one I'm going to pick. Conceptual understanding before skill. So first of all, this is not backed by any evidence. And I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about what conceptual understanding even means. It's actually not a well-defined term. So when we're saying things about conceptual understanding, we don't even really know what they mean half the time. All right. But I actually, the reason I want to dispel this myth is because I think it's one of the reasons that kids don't get enough practice with skills that they need to become good at. I think teachers are under the impression that they have to make sure that kids can do things in multiple ways, that they have to spend a lot of time with manipulatives and pictures and things like that before kids can get practice with the skill. And that doesn't seem to be backed by anything. And as a matter of fact, you can learn a skill and you can become really good at a skill, and then you can understand it later. And there is nothing wrong with that. And to hold students back, to hold them back from actually getting good at the skill in the pursuit of so-called conceptual understanding, I think can be quite harmful, to be honest. So that's the one I'd like to dispel. Do you have any thoughts on that, by the way? I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, and I've also learned that a lot of explicit, almost procedural type of teaching is often the way to explain the concept. And so one of the biggest conceptual pieces that comes up in the literature is around the equal sign, and that what's on this side has to be the same as on the other side. And kids in high school end up not understanding that. They think the equals means put the answer in the box, right, on the right side. But you can teach very early on that balance of the equations. But how do you teach that? Well, you need to put an equal sign up on the board, and you need to put a number on one side and a number on the other side. And are these numbers the same? No. How about these numbers? And you're essentially teaching through an explicit teaching lesson. You are showing the balance of the equations through lots of them, and then maybe making them balance them and put equal signs themselves. And you're really exploring a concept through lots of math. I find a lot of the conceptual stuff, like you said, is a distraction or a delaying of getting to the math, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And it's funny you bring up this equals sign stuff, because I've heard these arguments around the equals sign, and it's really? That's what you're worried about? Come on. You know, all you have to do is teach them that, right? And furthermore, you know, you can have two things on the side of an equal sign that aren't equal. That is a false statement, right? That's okay. So, you know, this nonsense about kids not understanding that the equal sign, you know, what it means in an equation? Well, it's your job to teach them that though, right? So, you know, I don't know. I don't know why people spend so much time on that, I have to say. But anyway.
Absolutely. And like, what ends up happening is that the way to somehow acquire that concept of equality or whatever else it is, some of them that are extremely abstract that I personally never arrived at learning in like calculus, but whatever that is, it's always meant that you're supposed to discover the concept. And that's the part I'm like, well, if anything, just teach them it, like just show them how to do like what it is and talk about it rather than withhold that information. I don't know.
Yes, of course. I completely agree with you.
Yeah. What about the math myth that you think is like, okay, it's still a myth. It's still counterproductive, but hey, there's elements of it that make it make sense why people would believe this.
All right. So I'm going to choose productive struggle. And hopefully people don't get upset with me on this one. But so I think the problem with productive struggle is the way it's presented and used. So it's often presented as, okay, you want to have the student struggle before receiving explicit instruction. And that just isn't going to go that well for most students. However, I think you do have to get students to a point where you can give them some problems and they can be tough problems and let them struggle with it a bit, because you do want students to be independent. Also, you know, a lot of students really love those challenging problems, and we need to make sure that we're helping those students too. Like, those students deserve good instruction as well. I think the issue is where it's placed on the instructional hierarchy, if we mention that. I just think that the students have to have achieved fluency with the skill, and then let's talk about getting them to use that skill in new settings. And I think that's where productive struggle could come in. I mean, you don't want to give students straightforward problems all the time, right? It can't always be exactly like what you do. But when you're first teaching someone something, it should be like that. Otherwise, they're not going to gain confidence or fluency with the skill.
Absolutely. I try to relate that to, like, there's this really good quote about, like, you shouldn't actually, you should deploy horses from like long-term memory is how the quote goes. Like, and that you shouldn't be relying on effortful thinking, you should be using long-term memory, right? And like, I think when you put them into a struggle type of problem, how much do they bring to bear to be able to grapple with that problem? How much do they have? And too often, I was just watching a lesson where the main kids that really needed a lot of support, all they knew in that type of problem was that a right angle looks like an L. And they're sitting there going like, yeah, so a right angle looks like an L. And everyone else is like, well, yeah, but there's all this math involved. And they're going, yeah, the only thing I have to contribute here is a very basic fact that I have basically rote memorized a long time ago. And it's like, well, this child needs more support. I completely agree with you. Like, there's something about challenge that needs to be in all classrooms, rigor. But I feel like we're teaching teachers to flip the whole instructional hierarchy on its head and just do lots of problems.
Yeah, precisely.
It kind of reminds me of our next question, which is around like intuition, like intuitive, like kind of reasoning. I think of the Rubik's Cube example, where you can learn the algorithms to solve a Rubik's Cube, like the standard way. Or let's say you get like a 9x9 Rubik's Cube, or you have some crazy kind of hexagonal Rubik's Cube. You can kind of spend 4 days figuring it out and using intuition to solve it. I guess I just want to know, like, what is the role of this kind of reasoning in math? Is it overhyped a bit, or what do you think?
Okay, so I have a certain idea in my mind of what mathematical intuition is, being a mathematician, and I'll tell you what I think it means. Maybe people can relate to this. So if you've been teaching for a long time, and you've taught something multiple times, what you notice over time is that students make the same mistakes. And so the next time you teach a group of students, it's a different group of students, but you're teaching the same concept, you kind of can predict what's going to happen. You know that these certain that students are likely going to make this particular mistake. So that's what I would call kind of teaching intuition, okay? So in math, the way I see mathematical intuition, and you know, we use that phrase all the time in the math world, is when you can kind of predict how a problem's gonna go. So you see a problem and you can predict in your mind a technique to use to solve that problem. And mathematical intuition generally comes with a lot of practice and a lot of knowledge of the field. So for example, I work in a particular field of mathematics and I have pretty good intuition in that field. I can look at a problem and I can say, okay, I can see in my mind that you could probably apply a certain technique to solve that problem. I could think of good questions to come out of that problem. But I could look at another field of mathematics and I would be able to understand the things in that field, like if someone explained those things to me, but I probably don't have good intuition about the field because I haven't really done a lot of work in the field. So that's kind of how I see mathematical intuition. Now, I don't know how other people see mathematical intuition, but I mean, I've seen some weird things. So I think if you rely too much on intuition, you can make a lot of mistakes. So as an example, you know, people in the education world, they like to explain division in terms of like, you know, drawing circles and putting dots in circles and trying to divide things up evenly and seeing how much is left over and stuff like this. So then if you use that argument and you try and make an argument for what is 0/0, say, and I've actually seen this, you won't believe this, but I've actually seen this in a curriculum document where, you know, they're making this argument that 0/0 is zero, which is absolutely incorrect. Like 0/0 is undefined. And the argument they're using is that, well, if you tried to divide zero cookies among zero friends, you know, each friend is going to get zero cookies, right? Like, yeah, it makes perfect sense, except like it's wrong. And that's because, you know, really what division means, it's just another way to write multiplication, like 56 divided by 7 is 8 because 7 times 8 is 56. So you, using that argument, you could say, well, 0/0 is 1 because 0 times 1 is 0, and 0/0 is 3 because 0 times 3 is 0, et cetera. And because it doesn't have a well-defined definition, 0/0 is undefined. So I mean, I got off on a tangent there, but okay, I was just teaching this in my class the other day because we're doing limits in calculus. So we have to talk about this type of form 0/0. And the students were saying, oh, we didn't realize why that was true, why 0/0 is undefined. But my point here is that if you rely too much on intuition, you can make a lot of mathematical errors, right? So at the end of the day, you have to actually have good, well-defined ways of doing things in math. Otherwise, you're going to make a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, I'm hearing like first part that you described was like that it's just an issue of transfer. Like it's sort of this skills and knowledge, like the domain specific way of math, of knowing like a certain part or subset of math. You can't even within your own subject, like often transfer your sort of reasoning and intuition to that area of math because you don't know it as well.
But exactly.
Even farther, of course, you want to transfer this to chemistry or to paleontology. It's just impossible. Like you can't, you need to know what the rules are, you know, and that's the other part is that math is just not natural is what I'm hearing. There are laws that we don't intuitively understand as human beings, a lot like physics where the kid, you know, drops two objects and thinks the bigger one goes faster. Like you sort of have these inbuilt misconceptions that you need to be oriented into the how things work in math by an expert who understands the laws.
Yes. Or it's like, do you play pool?
Yes.
Okay. So if you play a lot of pool, you have a shot, you kind of like, you know exactly where to hit, you know, if you're going to do like a bank shot or something like that, you can just see it, right? And a novice can't see that because they haven't done that so many, a lot of times. Math is like that. Or, you know, if you have Canadian listeners, it's like if you play hockey, and I don't play hockey. My husband played a lot of hockey. But if you play hockey, I think you kind of just know where to take that shot so that you're going to get it in the net, right? So math is a lot like that. It's if you've done a lot of math and you've done a lot of math problems, you can just see it. When you see the problem, you know kind of like how to do that problem. But it's something that comes with knowledge, experience, and practice.
Absolutely. Shifting a bit, you know, we sort of were talking about some of the myths around math and sort of how to approach those. We both get a lot of criticism, I think, because math is so charged, and the math wars, if you want to call them that, seem to be much more aggressive than the reading wars of late, because it's like the next frontier, I feel like. One of these topics that I don't really feel comfortable about addressing myself sometimes on the podcast is that one side of these math debates really emphasizes the importance of developing students' identities, like their math identities. And this is really important, I think, because I want girls to pursue math careers. Like I want my, you know, kids that don't see themselves as math people to become math people, or their parents didn't go to college and didn't and said I hated math. I want that to change. What do you think about this emphasis? And is it a distraction? Does it help? I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Okay. So yeah, I can definitely give my thoughts on that. So I think it's a distraction. I think it's a distraction, just like I think all the talk about time tests cause math anxiety. I think that's a distraction. I think that, you know, the real issue is that we have a lot of kids that have not learned math properly in K-8, maybe even K-6, maybe even K-3. And math is, as I say, relentlessly hierarchical. And so they can't learn later math. Okay, so, and that's what we need to concentrate on fixing. We're going to have more opportunities for more students if we can get K-8 math right. Okay, so that's the actual issue. So do girls feel left out of mathematics? I mean, I'm a mathematician. I've never felt shut out by mathematicians, but I sure do feel shut out by the education community a lot of the time. So I don't know. We want everyone to feel that they can do math. That is true, right? And actually everyone can do math to you know, a certain level. That's my opinion on that. But I think we miss the fact that the reason people are struggling in math and feeling like they don't belong is because they're sitting in math class and it's like the teacher is speaking Greek. Okay, because they're lost because they don't have the prerequisite skills. And a lot of the times the students don't realize that that's the reason. Like, that is the first thing I tell my students in first year university, because they'll come and they'll say things like that. Oh, I've never been good at math. It's like, no, that's not it. It's because you're missing a rung on the ladder, and maybe you didn't get enough practice on that skill. Maybe you didn't get good instruction on that skill. And now here you are trying to learn something later on the math ladder and you're missing a rung. And so it's really tough. And it does take some people longer than others to learn certain skills. So what? Okay, spend the time, make sure that they get that done. And at the end, if you can get two people to the point where they can do a math skill fluently, they are now equal. That is equality. That is equity in mathematics, right? It's not going around telling people we're all mathematicians. First of all, you're not. Like, Zach, you're not a mathematician, right? I'm a mathematician. You're not. Just like I'm not an instructional coach. Don't tell me I'm something I'm not, right? But you can't just go around telling people they're math people and thinking this is going to fix all the problems. You have to teach people math. You have to teach it well, and they have to get a lot of practice.
It's interesting because you get sent these too, I'm sure, like states and provinces, like new, I don't know, guidance documents. I know that there was some retraction work maybe happening in New York State that, you know, you've been privy to. A document I just saw in Illinois. These often try to take like a balanced approach, I suppose they think they do. But then it is like 80% this stuff. Like, you know, we're going to go beyond what math has been in the past and they sort of denigrate an old style of math. It's a caricature in a lot of ways. And we're going to focus on getting kids to identify as mathematicians. And really that I feel like that guidance doesn't help teachers. It might even persuade them to change the subject to be more like kind of a social studies type of conversation around, historical figures in math and things like that. I feel like it can really gut the essence of what makes math beautiful by focusing on things that aren't math. I mean, am I right on how I interpret these things?
You are 100% correct. And why are we denigrating traditional math? Like, what do you think brought you your phone? What do you think brought you AI? All the things that we use today, like, that is traditional math. That is people that were educated in a traditional style, right? So this doesn't make any sense. And I mean, okay, you tell me, you're in the schools all the time. Are there teachers out there that are telling kids that, this is a math person and this is not a math person? Is that happening? Because that would not be okay, right? But like, what's the worry here?
Especially when they get into secondary, that's never going to happen. You already decided to make this your career and pursue this as the subject you teach. I do think implicitly, early years elementary teachers, and I can say this because that's me and I'm amongst my people here, are guilty of saying to students, "Well, we have to do this math thing. I'm so sorry," because you're sort of apologizing for it. "I know it's boring. I was terrible at it. And so let's just suffer through it together." And I wonder that combined with bad teaching of math because they don't understand the subject and they don't have the training leads to this conclusion like, well, this is just for the top 1% of smart people or whatever it is,
Yeah, maybe. I don't think that's a good way to teach students. So first of all, the person at the front of the room should be an expert, right? So you should know what you're talking about, and you should tell students you know what you're talking about because you want them to be confident in you. And math isn't a chore. Even if you think it's a chore, you're going to have to pretend that you like it because it's your job to get the kids to like it. Right? It's your job to get the kids to learn it, to enjoy that time there, right? So I would say that I hope people aren't doing that too much. And the point is, we've got to make sure that students learn math well, and as long as you give them the skills and you give them the practice, they can do it.
And I don't think too, like, just to clarify that point, that it's really it's specific to math, because I think there's just generally kind of some anti-intellectualism in all the subjects where it's like, this boring knowledge, this old history stuff, and let's just get through it so we can get to the fun part. Jeez, like, stand up and be proud of what this stuff is.
Yeah.
Show you like it, you know?
Zach, I actually want to say one more thing about math identity because I actually Googled this because I'm curious to know what is being said about math identity. And I found all these sorts of things like this. Until we redefine what it means to be good at math, we will continue perpetuating the misconception that being good at math is only associated with those who are quick at calculations. So it's giving people a license to not ensure that kids are fluent. And what that does is it perpetuates the cycle of people like not being able to do math and math anxiety, right? It comes from like not being able to do math. And then it goes further. We need to move away from teaching through telling. We need to move beyond do it like me math instruction to create more opportunities for our students to see themselves as not only capable mathematicians, but natural keepers of mathematical knowledge. Like what? Like that is like, so like, look, it's that the first statement does not imply the second one, right? Like, they're saying that in order for students to see themselves as mathematicians, we have to teach them in ways that don't use explicit instruction. That's what that's saying. So they're using it as an excuse to push a particular pedagogical method.
And I think what you're going to get is a lot of kids who come out of high school, like just sort of disillusioned with math as a result. You're going to get the person who goes, you know what, guys, math is everywhere, but like can't, you know, has trouble doing their taxes, like has trouble calculating pennies and dollars at the store. And you and but math is everywhere, but how and what where the application is gone because there just wasn't enough practice, I think.
Well, and also, don't you think people know this? Like, you can't just tell someone they're a math person. Like, what good does that do them? If they're in an algebra class, they're trying to solve an algebraic equation and they can't add fractions, right? They won't be able to do it. You have to teach them how to add fractions for them to be able to solve that question. Then they become a math person because, well, then at that point, they're able to do the math.
I wonder about this thing. It's sort of related where we want to teach kids that even in math, there's no right answer. I mean, this is so the argument goes. It's like applying a different epistemology, like that of history or debatable questions to math, so that kids don't feel like they're being sort of that this isn't being imposed upon them, that they can think creatively with it or something. I mean, have you heard this as well?
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought this up. Okay, so there's no right answer. So here's what I think about that argument. I think this is just a way of excusing teachers from ensuring that the children know how to do a particular mathematical skill. They're all equal, right? Like it doesn't matter. Come up with your own method. No, actually, some methods are better than others. It's true, right? And usually there is a correct answer. We do care about your technique. And if you just made a tiny error at the end, that's not a big deal. But usually there is a right answer. And usually there is a best way of doing something. And, you know, I had this really interesting discussion with someone on social media once. And this was kind of illuminating for me. And so in Canada, they push multiple strategies a lot. In schools. So the kids are learning multiple ways to do things. So they would learn multiple ways to do a multiplication problem. And every way is equal, no way is better. Pick your way, right? Because, you know, we want you to be seen, et cetera. And the standard algorithm isn't the best one when, yeah, it is, because it's the most efficient. It works in all the cases. I mean, it's not always the best to use in every situation, but generally it's the best algorithm. And anyway, I was saying something negative about this approach, that it gets children confused, that they never become good at any one method. And a teacher kind of said something like, you know, that's not fair because some of my kids can't learn the standard algorithm. So they need another approach. And I suppose this is because, you know, if you're using base 10 blocks or you're drawing pictures or something like that, that's a really rudimentary way of doing a problem, right? It's like doing it in sort of this like I would say even sort of an archaic, like, you know, kind of way. It's regressive actually if you're going to use that for calculations, because we do have a good place value system that allows us to use a standard algorithm. And so I kind of thought, oh wait, so this is like an excuse. It's like a way to say, you know what, I've actually taught the outcome. My kids can add, when actually they're reliant on these really clunky strategies. So yeah, what are your thoughts on it?
Let's just return to that whole math identity thing. Like, it's like, what do you feel, no matter how much the teacher lays the groundwork that all methods matter, everyone can be doing a different method, and so on? How do you feel as the student sitting there where you have three pieces of paper covered in drawings and you're just stumbling and guessing and making stuff up based on this method where you can't even keep track of your work, versus the student next to you who's done 30 problems in a very small space and light and just is showing how much they love math? And over here, I'm just like, I just feel like I'm just engaging in a lot of humoring of the teacher and guesswork to get through this. Like, that would hurt my math identity. That would make me not feel like a math person. I'm like, maybe I'm more destined for art than math. I just find that silly, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And really, you do need to tell students that Okay, great. That's nice that you use this method and maybe you got to the right answer in the end, or maybe you have a different way of doing it. But I just want to mention that your method, it's going to take a long time. And so it's going to take you longer to do the problems, and it's more likely that you're going to make mistakes. And that method may not work in other settings. So I want to make sure that you know how to use this method. And I would strongly advise that that's the method you use. Because this, I see this all the time, right? Like students come and they're novice learners, right? So they will do things in ways that aren't efficient or are more likely to cause errors. Okay, so and that's fine, like that's part of learning, but then it's our job to guide them it to being able to do questions in the most efficient way so they're less likely to make errors and so that they can generalize that method into other situations.
I love that. And and how I teach, like, for example, like you a lot of students start by counting on their fingers and they move from that to perhaps drawing lines underneath the horizontal addition to finally just counting on from the first number and adding the second number to eventually just remembering the math fact, right? Like we want to go to the fast way, but the kids find it fun that we're adopting the new fast way. Like, which would you rather take, the fast way to recess or the slow way? Everyone goes the fast way, and you go, so I'm going to show you a more efficient way than we've been doing because we've been using a building block towards something that's a lot more efficient. Let's do it. Kids love to figure that, oh wow, it takes me half the amount of time, and he properly taught it. I'm curious about this idea that that's sort of we're alluding to of the levels that students can eventually be expected to obtain in school. It's such a big question. A lot of people, I didn't make it to calculus largely because I lived in France during high school and didn't take any math, and I had to then go into college and I had to go back and take like a 101 course, and I realized how much my math had slipped. And there's other folks that would argue, we should just cut our losses and not force kids through math too much in high school if they say they're not math people. What is the answer to this when it comes to secondary education and the ultimately like the foundation every child should have in math, regardless of future plans?
Yeah, so this is a really tough question for me because I do see the fallout from kids making bad choices or, being advised not to take further math. I do see the fallout because kids actually don't know what they're going to want to be in the future. Even a first-year university student doesn't know often, okay? And I think that the role of education is to maximize opportunities for students. And I just would want to say to anybody listening that if students don't get a good foundation in math, it shuts them out of a lot of things, right? So they wouldn't be able to take science in university. They wouldn't be able to take economics, business, data science, like anything involving math. And even the trades. So I don't know what to say because if it's my kid and my kids both went through high school, I mean, I expect them to get to pre-calculus, because I know that that's going to open doors for them. Now, whether they need it or not for what they're doing is another story, but I want them to be able to have opportunities. So, okay, now recognizing that it doesn't always work out that way, I'm going to list a few things that I think everyone should know. Okay, so I think everybody should be able to do basic arithmetic. So you should be able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. Okay, I think people should be able to work with percents and ratios. I think people should be able to do fraction arithmetic. I think they should be able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide fractions. And they should be able to work with integers. So your positive and negative whole numbers and zero. Okay. It would be good if they could solve a linear equation at the very least, because at least maybe then they could like stream into an algebra course later if they need to. So I would say some of those things. And I do want to emphasize that because sometimes people say, oh, I only care about the people who are going to end up in university. And that's how I see things. And I want to mention that actually I have two brothers, and neither one of them went to university. They're very successful and they work in the trades. And so my one brother was a mechanic, and now he, you know, he became a pipe fitter, and they've both taken like pipe fitting licensing exams. They've both taken like, well, my one brother has taken the welder's exam to get certified as a welder. And there's a lot of math on those exams. And you'd be surprised how much math is on those exams, like some basic trigonometry even. So, and people in the trades are complaining that a lot of students coming out of schools don't have basic math skills, because they're going to need to be able to work with fractions. They need to be able to do that quickly, right? When they're trying to work things out, and they'll probably need to be able to work with angles pretty well. So I think, you know, we do have to ensure a certain level of mathematical competency if we want kids to have opportunities at all.
And this whole like invisible or unpredictable nature of like your life and where it takes you and the journey is so important to me. I mean, I became a teacher and that very thing happened. I realized, great, now I actually have to know how this stuff works to be able to explain it to kids. I never thought I needed this. Now I do. I tried to go get my PhD and I noticed all of these folks, I mean, I got my PhD, but as I was doing it, I realized all of these folks were avoiding the quantitative side of doing a dissertation on the basis of their fear of what the math would be. And I pursued quantitative anyway, even though I felt deficient in math. And then, you know, I just think like you end up becoming a teacher and then you become a principal. Now you're meant to observe math teachers, and now you don't even know what you're looking at. And there are all of these things that ultimately for me, education means opening doors and allowing kids to choose their paths. We really do kids a disservice by saying, you know what, let's cut our losses. That's my view. And that this is enough for you, and you can choose to opt out of math too early. I think we just need to give that a second consideration.
Exactly. And I mean, actually, I've encountered situations where parents have contacted me and said they went to a math night at the school. And they were kind of advising, you know, like, it's really hard for these kids. Like, it's they don't really need to take the pre-calculus stream. Look at me. I didn't take pre-calculus. I'm fine, right? Like, and they'll say, well, you know, they could take the remedial math course at university. And I just want to say they can take the remedial math course at university. So it isn't ever really too late, but the success rates in those courses are very low, and they tend to be non-credit, and they're packed into, you know, university level pace, which is quite fast. It's better if students really could take it in high school with their teacher over the longer term like that. So I think we have to be really careful when we're advising high school students, just to let them know, you know, sometimes things are tough, right? Like, it's true. Like, math requires a lot of practice, and it can be hard, but hard work tends to pay off. You know, like, you, at the end, you've done it, and now you have more opportunities for the future, which is going to make your life easier later on.
There's a lot of privilege, I think, built into this, because I went to community college for my first 2 years, and that's where, you know, basically free college. And I'm surrounded by all these folks in that first math course who have been working for upwards of 2-3 years to get through math 80 and 90 and finally get to that math course, just so that they can finish an associate's degree. And that's what's been holding them back, not their ability to read Shakespeare, not their ability to write a 5-paragraph essay, but this one math course that has been stuck in their way. And that's where the anxiety lies. It lies in those rooms, mm-hmm. where all of this past sort of under teaching now is preventing them from becoming a nurse or becoming something else. It's just really unfortunate.
It is. And it's also what you're talking about. So I'm well aware of this situation. And you could be talking about a student who maybe actually comes into post-secondary at a grade 4 level. And to catch up on that amount of math is really, really tough. We do have to do a better job generally, I think, of just making sure that students don't fall through the cracks in K to 12.
Just kind of to close out here, this is my sort of final question. It's just around, like, you see things from a different perspective. You work in the math department, and right in the university of every university is an education department. Like, do you see there being a disconnect between what we're talking about and what is going on in a lot of teacher prep programs?
Yeah, I do. And I can't speak for every university around the world. I can definitely speak for what goes on in my province, not just at my own university, but the other large university in the province. And there's also a smaller university in Brandon. But so the way it tends to work in universities is mathematicians teach content. So we teach math, okay? And in the education faculty, they teach pedagogy, all right? And I don't know what it's like at other universities, but around here and probably in a lot of Canada, the focus on the pedagogy piece is generally constructivism. And as you know, I don't really think that's a great way to teach. I don't think it's supported by strong research evidence. I prefer things more on the quantitative side of things as opposed to the qualitative side of things. And so the other thing is, actually, most mathematicians won't weigh in on pedagogy. They just will not weigh in on it because they don't see themselves as experts on pedagogy. And I would encourage more mathematicians to weigh in, because we do teach math and we know a lot of math. I certainly know a lot about pedagogy, and that has been self-taught. So I definitely weigh in on it, but I don't think that I'm that popular. Actually, I know I'm not that popular among education faculties, which actually isn't that surprising. It's, you know, it's fine, because I do sort of criticize some of the things, right? But I would say some of the things that mathematicians would have in common, even though they don't weigh in on pedagogy a lot of the time, they are very serious about math, and they will want students to learn a lot of math. They'll want teachers to know a lot of math. So mathematicians would often advocate for something like math specialists in elementary school, which is something I've advocated for in the past, but they generally stay out of pedagogy, and it's completely disjoint. So education teaches pedagogy and math teaches content. And that's kind of how it works in the universities. I'd be happy to teach pedagogy sometime.
and like you said, the pedagogy ends up being very sort of belief-based and ideological in the first place, which doesn't do anybody any good. We'll have to close out here because we're running out of time. Everybody that's listening to this, definitely add Chalk and Talk with Anna Stocky to your podcast list. And what else can we do to kind of follow you and what you're currently working on?
Well, okay. So yeah, you can follow me on LinkedIn or X. I'm going to be doing some work with La Trobe University School of Education, actually, in Australia. So right now I'm preparing a masterclass with an associate professor there. Her name is Chrissy, and I apologize because I actually don't know how to pronounce her last name, but it's like Montalioni. But anyway, you could check that out. I actually have it on my website, so anyone can register anywhere in the world. So we're doing a little masterclass on math fluency in October. And I think you'll hear more to come on that in the future. And I've got lots of great guests lined up, so I'm really excited for that. I'm doing some video with the podcast right now, so I'm kind of experimenting with that. We'll see if I stick with it. Most of my listeners definitely are audio, actually the majority. So yeah, so you can check that out and stay tuned for some awesome guests. And you have been an awesome guest, and I really admire your work. And I think very highly of you, and I want to thank you for everything that you do to get the message out there about explicit instruction and good teaching, and I really admire your passion.
Thank you. And I will see you soon in person in Manitoba, I'm sure, very soon. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. Take care.